entering Kenmore, doors will open on the left.
How's it going, everybody? Welcome to episode 11 of Entering Kenmore. I am David Azer alongside Zach Coe. Zach, it was another interesting week of baseball for the Boston Red Sox. This was really a tale of two series as we had the home opener over the weekend versus the St. Louis Cardinals. Both you and I predicted a sweep, and that's what it ended up being. So a lot of takeaways from that series, mostly pretty good.
Credit to us for calling the sweep there. We read all those Cardinals pitchers like a fucking book. We were like, oh, yeah, this guy sucks. This guy. And no one sucks more than Miles Michaelis. I mean, that guy's just good fucking Lord. Rinsed. He's just absolutely washed. I mean, he didn't look even remotely good. Eric Fetty looked decent there in the home opener. He settled in after the first inning with the back-to-back bombs. And then, obviously, with the rain out Saturday, we got Andre Pallante on Sunday afternoon, we'll call it. And he looked okay, but obviously the real story of that game was future Red Sox closer Ryan Helsley doing the boys a favor, helping the fellas improve their playoff position for when he joins the club in late July. And then, obviously, Sunday Night Baseball was just an absolute ass-kicking, boat racing, whatever, however you want to call it. They just beat the absolute dog shit out of the Cardinals in that.
Yeah, it was a fun series pretty much throughout. Got a little bit dicey in game one, so the Red Sox ended up winning 13-9. But that didn't really tell the whole story. So the Red Sox had a 5-run first inning after blanking the Cardinals in the top of the first. I believe this is when Story and Abreu went back to back, and then we saw the debut of the home run celebration. Where are you at
on this? Which is awesome. I love it. It's so good. There have been other ones where, I'm like, oh, these are kind of lame. Like the dumbbells, I thought the inflatable dumbbells were stupid. If they brought out like even if they just brought out like 20-pound dumbbells and had guys who hit bombs doing curls in the dugout with actual dumbbells, that would have been awesome.
Yeah.
I liked the laundry cart. What else? The marathon medal. I understand it. It wasn't even a marathon medal. It was a 5K medal, and it was Cora's. I thought that one was kind of dumb. Mm-hmm. Like I understand that Cora ran the 5K and whatever, but I don't know. I thought that was – this one's by far the best one that they've done.
Oh, absolutely. And I think it – I've heard some people mentioning that it seems like they just put more thought into this, which, I mean, a lot of teams do. You've seen, like, the Mariners have their weird trident thing, which I think is kind of sick. It's just something to rally the fans in. Yeah, I like that one too. Yeah. And I mean, there have been some other cool ones that I'm blanking on right now. But as a whole, I think
the Reds.
Oh,
yeah. Reds last year, they did the Viking thing with the helmet.
Yeah.
And, like a type deal. That one was pretty cool. I'm blanking. What was it? The Mets did like the rally ham or some shit.
I think it was the Twins.
Oh, the Twins. Yeah. The Twins did the rally ham, which was disgusting. I saw a lot of like an odd amount of people that were bitching about the sanitation of this helmet. Why do you care? Like, oh, isn't that thing going to be pretty gross smelling? It like, well, they're all adults and they have a staff that's dedicated to cleaning things for them. Like, that doesn't feel like something that goes beyond the purview of the staff that can clean stuff for them. And also like, these guys have it on for like 5 seconds. So like, oh, it's going to be disgusting, Bigel. Who cares? Like, why do you care? Like, you're a random person. Like,
yeah, it's also like, make another one. I don't know. Or have a couple in rotation. Like, I think there are very clear avenues to getting around that non-issue.
Yeah. And like, it seems like it was kind of a pain in the ass to get, because I don't know if you saw the video of Duran telling the story of it, but he was like, yeah, I asked Raquel if we could do this, and she was like, I'll see what I can do, but don't hold your breath. And then all of a sudden it showed up for the home opener, which was I'd rather they debut it at the home opener. That's way funnier to just like play a week of baseball and then get home to Fenway and be like, bam, fucking Wally head home run celebration. Like, right on your skulls. It's awesome. And also, while we're on it, shout out Raquel. She is awesome by all accounts. I'm only a couple episodes into the Netflix doc, but she's been a big piece of that so far, obviously, with the, I won't spoil it for you because I know you haven't gotten into it yet, but with the Bayo dinner and things like that. I mean, obviously, I'm not there. I'm not within the organization, but everything that you hear about Raquel is sick. It's why she was my pick when before they hired Breslow as the next head of baseball ops. That's who I wanted them to go with. So for her to pull that out, and obviously the players love it and the fans seem to be embracing it pretty much wholeheartedly as well.
Yeah, it's awesome to see people like that getting noticed, you know, getting recognized for those things that maybe go on behind the scenes that you won't always hear them getting credit for. So it's cool on both sides, both on Duran and obviously with Raquel to be facilitating all this. I do wonder, is the Wally Head going to travel with the team now, do you think, or is that only
a home? I would guess it will. I would guess that it's everything now. Like when they muck up fucking Martin Davis or Davis Martin, excuse me. Don't have two first names and I won't fuck up your name, Davis. once they shell him in that generic make a stadium ballpark out in the south side tonight, I'm sure we'll see the Wally Head again.
Yeah, have you been to the Chicago? I mean, we're jumping around here, but have you been there?
Yeah, I've been there. It's not that bad. Like, I don't know, in the Netflix doc they show a series in Chicago, and when they win a game, it was either Duran or someone, like, it the subtitles didn't say who it was, but it sounded like Duran was like, let's get out of this shithole. I wouldn't go as far as to call it a shithole. It's just, it's kind of boring. Like, there isn't anything special about it. Like, they used to have Goose Island. It's a brewery in Chicago. Mm. They used to have a giant goose up on top of, like, some sort of facade in left field. Cool. And they did away with that. So that was, like, a unique thing that they got rid of. And they keep fucking with the name. At first, it was U.S. Cellular, obviously, mm-hmm. the cell. The old school White Sox fans still know it as Comiskey Park, which I never knew it to be that. But I knew it as the cell, and then it was Guaranteed Rate Field, and now it's just Rate Field, which is, like, easily the worst name of the bunch. But back to the larger point of it, it's just kind of a whatever stadium. Like, it's just a generic ballpark. Like, everyone makes a big deal out of it being on the south side, but, like, it's like only, it's not really, like, it's like it is technically on the south side, and also during games, like, there's such a big police presence there. I mean, you like what there is at Fenway, that, like, mm-hmm. everyone's like, oh, be careful when you go on the south side. It's like, okay, well, I think I'll be okay going to a baseball game. But yeah, the larger point is it's just kind of a whatever ballpark.
Yeah, that's kind of where I'm at too. Like, I would probably put it in, like, the bottom third around, like, some other cookie cutter type stadiums.
Let me see where I have it. I obviously, you've been to all 30 stadiums minus the minor league parks, and I've only been to like 8, but let me see where I have it ranked.
I wonder if I could find it too. But yeah, I mean, while you're looking for that, I can touch on the rest.
I have it second to last.
Oh, you got it. Okay.
Yeah, right after the Trop, or right before the Trop.
Or the corpse of the Trop at this point.
yeah, right after the Trop, I Nationals Park was my favorite one that I've been to.
Interesting. So okay. Yeah, I mean, I've honestly, in my mind, I was kind of looping those two together. Like, they both feel kind of lacking personality a bit.
Yeah, I liked Nationals Park just because, like, we got good seats where you can kind of look out and see, like, the Capitol and all that
stuff. Oh, yeah.
You get those seats. It's pretty cool. I also haven't been to any of the really cool ones. Like, I've been to Wrigley, too. Wrigley was number two. I ranked them all with Fenway, like, not counting as number one. So, like, technically Wrigley would be two and move everything down. But, like, I haven't been to PNC. I haven't been to what do they call San Francisco now? Oracle. Yeah, I haven't been there. I haven't been to San Diego. Most of the West Coast ones I haven't been to, and those are the PNC is another one that I really want to get to. I haven't been to yet.
Yeah.
So all the renowned ones, all the ones everyone's like, oh, you got to get to this one. I haven't been there yet, so my list is kind of lacking right now.
Yeah, that's fair. I mean, if you're adding to list Coors Field. Banger. Seattle.
Yeah, that's another one. Yeah. I was outside the Seattle stadium, but when I went to Seattle, it was not baseball season, so I didn't get to catch a game there. I also am stupid, and I want to, like, I'm only counting it if I see the Red Sox play there. So, like, if I go to a game, but, like, at Miller Park, I haven't seen the Red Sox play there. I guess I did count that one when I went, so. So I guess I'm not consistent on that one at all.
Hey, it's all good. Whatever you're feeling, however you want to, you know, do the rest of the quest. Yeah. It was, I don't know if how often I really saw the Red Sox, maybe like twice, throughout the whole thing. But, yeah, I mean, I guess ballpark tangent aside, so game one happened in the Cardinals series. It definitely did. The Red Sox put up. Yeah, they put up five runs in the bottom of the first. That was when we saw the Wally Head back-to-back home runs from Story and Abreu. And then it just kind of got away from them a bit. The pitching was a little bit suspect. So Bueller pitched five innings, gave up five runs, only walked one, four strikeouts, gave up two homers, but seven hits on the day. And then you kind of got to the point where it was a little bit of a blowout, so they put in Cooper Criswell, who's your why am I blanking on his first name? Anderson, right? Chase Anderson.
Chase Anderson.
Right?
Yeah. Yeah. What? Ed Hand calls him like the Chase Anderson Memorial Human White Flag / Human Victory Cigar.
Yeah. Yeah. So that's basically what they did in this game, and then Chapman ended up having to come in the ninth. So obviously you wanted to avoid Chapman, but you'll take the home opening win however you can get it.
He didn't really even technically have to come in. Like, what, they won by five?
They won by four.
Four, okay, so that's a little closer than maybe it is Chapman time. But, like, even so, like, if you're Cooper Criswell, what did Criswell give up? What was his final line?
His final line was, he pitched a third of an inning. He gave up four hits, three runs, two earned.
Yeah, I mean, if you're the guy that's coming in when the games are wrapped and you're giving up four runs or whatever it was, like, there's a reason they sent him to AAA after that, because that's just not something that we can have happen. Like, you can't be coming in. Like, and I know Chase Anderson also sucked, but when you were putting him in with a big league lead, it felt like you were never getting into those high leverage arms there. And
right.
I don't know. I'm not a Cooper Criswell guy to begin with because of the lack of swing and miss. And also, like, he's just like, he's a boring pitcher. Like, you know what you're going to get when he's a starter. He doesn't give you much. He's at most a five and dive guy where you hope you can limit contact. But I don't know. They brought up Robert Stock for 8 hours to replace Criswell, and then they sent Stock back to AAA and brought up Josh Winkowski, who I never want to see in a Boston Red Sox uniform ever again. Yeah, so, like, it's kind of like, what are your other options?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I mean, they ended up winning the game, so I can't get too mad at them for this. Overall, it was a good offensive showing. I mean, 13 runs, especially when Fenway Park was pretty cold. I mean, this was the only day where the weather was not below like 40 degrees. So,
which is a miracle. Shout out to the weather gods for that one, for giving us one beautiful day for opening day. I mean, it was in the 60s. It was sunny. Yeah. It was a great day. Obviously the Sox come out and immediately put up a five spot for the home crowd. And then the weather immediately turned to shit and hasn't turned back yet.
Yeah, yeah. What was the vibe boots on the ground for home opener?
It was great. I mean, I go to pretty much every home opener, and everyone says, like, oh, like, the vibes were incredible. The vibes are always great on opening day. Like, we're a fairly delusional fan base, even when the expectations aren't super high. Like, for opening day, people are always going to show up, and people are always going to be, like, ready to go for baseball to start. But this one did feel a little bit different, obviously, with the excitement of welcome to Boston, Garrett Crochet, like all that stuff, Alex Bregman and everything. And then obviously for them to just come out immediately swinging the bats the way they did was great. It did feel like the expectations were raised, which obviously they are raised, because it feels like we're actually finally, like, turning a corner and getting back to the Red Sox of old. And I know we're jumping ahead here a little bit, but on Sunday Night Baseball, Buster Olney said that friends of John Henry were saying that he's been reinvigorated and he's refound his love of baseball. And it seems like it's not just baseball, because Liverpool extended Mo Salah to a pretty big deal today too. So it feels like he's kind of, whatever it was that he, my friend texted me, it was like, I think John Henry was visited by the ghost of Christmas future and decided to get back to his spending ways, which was which is nice. But yeah, it was a good environment, and I was obviously had the doubleheader on the radio side on Sunday, and that those crowds all felt fantastic as well.
Nice, glad to hear it. Yeah, I went on Tuesday, and we're jumping ahead a bit more here, but that was fucking freezing. But even still, for the weekday games, when you don't expect maybe many people to come out on a super cold night, it's still a pretty good turnout throughout the whole homestand, I feel like.
I was there Monday for the, well, I originally wanted to go for the Crochet debut, which obviously got pushed to Tuesday with the doubleheader. We got a Dickey Fitz start, but the Duran bobblehead night, I know we're going to get into the Duran stuff, but that was the only day that there was rain, and obviously it was freezing. Yeah. I think I texted my friend, it felt like 17 or something like that during the bulk of that game. But that was even a pretty decent crowd too, and it filled in really nicely. We got there right when gates opened at 5:15, so we could get the bobbleheads, obviously. Mm-hmm. But which also, those are pretty sick too. I have mine right here, so I can show
those. Oh, that is sick.
Yeah, pretty sweet giveaway that they did. But even that one filled in really nicely, and we were like, oh, we thought we were going to be able to sit wherever we wanted, which we were able to sit wherever we wanted, but it took a couple times bouncing around to actually find a spot where we could all go and not have anybody being like, oh, I think you guys are in our seats, which, like,
again, oh yeah,
we still were able to do that, and we were still in good seats. But it was, I thought once we got there at 5:30 and found a random set of seats to sit in up in the grandstand, like right around home plate, that we were like, all right, this is where we're going to be for the game. And that wasn't the case.
Yeah. I mean, I like trying to jump around and find some good seats. I feel like more often though, I'm stationary and wherever my tickets say, just because I don't want to be bopping around too much.
It takes a certain game to, like, I think a Monday, like that Monday game, rainy, it feels like 17, like that's the perfect game where you can bop around and find a spot. And like we didn't even miss any like actual game time. This was all like pregame where we had to move a couple times.
Oh yeah. That ain't bad.
Or maybe it was even just once, but like, other than that, I usually am with you. I like to, once we're there, I like to be pretty stationary, but I'm not afraid to bop around and try and find some open seats.
Yeah, I might have to do that more, to be honest. But yeah, so game two of this Cardinals series, which was initially rained out on Saturday. So this was Sunday afternoon. This was a game the Red Sox really had no business winning. They ended up beating the Cardinals in 10 innings, largely in part. Pretty much the only reason they won this game is that Ryan Helsley absolutely pissed down his leg. So here's his line is, the Red Sox were, well, first off, the Red Sox were down 4-2 heading into the bottom of the ninth. Helsley comes on for the save. This is a guy who led the league in saves last year, I'm pretty sure. And
NL reliever of the year.
Yeah. And a big trade piece that people have been floating for a while, because the Cardinals are probably going nowhere. But here's his line. So he pitched an inning of work, one hit. He gave up two runs. He walked four and he struck out two. What an interesting line.
So weird. Oh, man.
Yeah, four walks, yeah, but also two Ks.
And that's just kind of the nature of the beast with this Red Sox lineup. I mean, we know what they are. I think they're – I'll pull it up right now, but I believe they're second in the league in strikeouts behind the Cubs, who obviously have played two more games than everybody else because of the Japan series. And I don't know, like, this is I'm going to talk about it a little bit, but the strikeouts, it's just, nothing pisses me off more than one, non-competitive at-bats, two, non-competitive at-bats that end in strikeouts. Mm-hmm. And we didn't see it that much in the St. Louis series. Obviously, they scored, like, I have the numbers up right now. In that St. Louis series, they hit 385 Four home runs, 36 runs scored. They worked 20 walks to 20, or I guess 21 if you count an intentional walk, to 21 strikeouts. They only a 15% strikeout rate, a slugging percentage of 598. I mean, it was just obviously a fantastic series. The Red Sox offense as a whole put up a 2.1 war in that series. So, like, it's hard to get mad about that. But in the Toronto series, there was a lot of uncompetitive at-bats and a lot of at-bats that ended in strikeouts, specifically in the Kevin Gausman start, which was, what, Wednesday night?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, Wednesday night, they struck out 14 times. They didn't – I think I texted you bitching about this. For, like, innings six through eight, they just didn't have a competitive at-bat. Like, Devers and Christian Campbell were the only ones that were able to put the bat on the ball. And Devers with two leadoff doubles then ends up getting stranded on second base twice. And then Campbell with a leadoff single, I think it was in the seventh, he ends up getting stranded too. And they go KKK right there. Not – like,
oh yikes,
you know what I mean. Yeah. you know what I mean. But yeah, it's just it was a frustrating series in Toronto, but we're not talking about that one yet. We're talking about the St. Louis series, which, like I said, was awesome.
Yeah, the vibes were high on this series, especially going from a tough Texas series to kind of redeeming yourself in Baltimore and then coming home and sweeping the Cardinals. That was really fun. Also, just before we move on to game three, I wanted to mention this was the game where Rafael Devers hit his first home run of the year. And can everybody please just shut up about him, because he's back to hitting like 280 or so. And he's fine.
Yeah, I got Devers stats. Devers stats. So obviously we know that he started out 0 for 21 with 19 strikeouts or whatever it was, just the worst start historically that we've ever seen in Major League Baseball since then, which is now 9 games. He's hitting .429 with a .488 OBP, a .657 slug, which is an .1145 OPS. He's only struck out 5 times in that 9-game span, and he's walked 5 times. He has 5 doubles, a home run, 8 RBIs. So all you fucking morons that were sitting there saying, oh, trade him, let's get Casas and Devers out of here and bring in 6 months of Vlad Guerrero Jr. First of all, never watch the games again, because if those are your takes, you don't deserve to watch baseball anymore. Second of all, it's like we said in the last episode, take a deep breath and shut the fuck up. Like, it was five games that he was bad in. And we had people being like, oh, send him to AAA. Like, if you think they're sending Rafael Devers to AAA, one, you don't know the rules of the sport, because you can't send him to AAA. And two, again, stop watching. Stop watching the games. Stop listening to this podcast. Stop. You don't deserve to have those takes and be able to enjoy any of the things associated with the sport of baseball.
Couldn't have said it better myself, man. And it's awesome to see how quick of a turnaround this was. Like, it's black and white at this point. And if people still have stuff to say about Rafael Devers, then, I mean, just go somewhere else, please.
Yeah, if you still have something negative to say about Rafael Devers, then maybe you're some of the people that took the KKK that I said earlier a little bit too literally in that. And I know there are people that, like, I mean, how many calls did we get that were like, hey, Rafael Devers, he doesn't speak English in his press conferences. Like, why? You're playing baseball in America. You got to speak English. Like, he speaks English. He doesn't speak English in the press conferences because dickheads like you have reactions like that.
Yep. It's a tired argument, and I mean, Devers is fine. Devers has always been a streaky hitter. I imagine he's going to fall back down to earth at some point, but I firmly believe the worst part of this season is behind him, and at this point it will be not a conversation for the rest of this year.
Well, like, how much different is his current line, obviously not counting stats-wise, going to be at the end of the season from where he's at now? .278, .375 OBP with a .426 slug for an .801 OPS, .130 OPS+. I mean, his career line, is 279 with a 346 OBP, a 509 slug, and an 855 OPS.
Mm-hmm.
So this is probably pretty close to the Devers we're going to get. I mean, obviously, he's not going to be hitting 460 or whatever the number was that I said there. But, like, this is the guy that you can expect to get. Like, I think the batting average, I think there's room to grow there. I think he can probably be closer to a 290 hitter. Obviously, I think there's more room on the slug because he's 80, almost 90 points lower on his career average on the slug. But, like, I don't think it's a stretch to say that Rafael Devers could be a top 5 to 10 finisher in the MVP race. I mean, we know obviously how DHs get valued, but like it doesn't seem to matter for Ohtani. And I'm not saying that Rafael Devers is Shohei Ohtani, but I mean, we saw David Ortiz be in the mix for MVPs in his career. So like, I do think there's an MVP at some point in Devers' career. Like, at least he certainly has that potential. I mean, fuck, I've talked about it on this podcast before. Last year, before the shoulder started barking, he was on pace to have a career year. He was on pace to be a top five finisher in that MVP race. Now, obviously, last year with what Judge did, nobody was catching him, and obviously Bobby Witt emerged, and there were other guys that were more than capable of winning that MVP. But if Devers stayed healthy, there's no reason to think he wouldn't have been in that mix as well.
And how cool is it to have other productive hitters around him? Because this lineup is so much deeper than it was just a year ago with Bregman and with other guys, you know, taking that next step in their development with Abreu and obviously Christian Campbell and Trevor Story, who's stayed healthy so far and has been a pretty productive hitter so far this year. Just feels like there's a different vibe around this lineup as a whole. Like, There were a ton of times last year and years prior that when certain people came up in big spots, I was like, okay, inning overall, I like keeping score during games. And I would turn to my dad and just be like, should I just write the out in now? And at this point, it's like, it feels like pretty much 1 through 9 guys can produce.
Well, aside from Connor Wong, who's hurt now. But
yes, the reason I bring that up is because he's hurt right now. And I like Carlos Narvaez a lot more. Although he didn't have a great day yesterday. But all this to say that the lineup just feels much more balanced 1 through 9. Even a Rafaela, who tends to swing a pool noodle, can come through occasionally. And if that's your 9-hitter, I'm totally fine with that. But yeah, so we saw the blowout in Sunday Night Baseball. I caught the tail end of this game. I was in a movie, and I was checking the score on my phone. And it just kept getting higher and higher. At the point I got out of the movie, I think it was 10-1. And then they kind of let the Cardinals come back a bit, not going to lie. But Hunter Dobbins made his major league debut and was pretty solid.
Yeah, he generated a lot more swings and misses than I was anticipating. Mm-hmm. I admittedly didn't know too much about him, or I was going to say a whole lot, I guess, about him coming up into the system. But obviously, we know with the Quinn Priester trade and the fact that Dobbins got the start over him. I don't know how the line or how the rotation lined up in AAA. So maybe it was just simply that it was Dobbins' day in the rotation down there and Priester wouldn't have been ready to go. Mm-hmm. But obviously, we saw him get it over Priester for whatever reason. And then they go on to, trade Priester. So we know that that wasn't a roadblock for him. But yeah, I was impressed with Dobbins. Obviously, things got off to a little bit of a rocky start. He gave up a run in the first inning, some hard contact, and then he settled in nicely. I mean, obviously, it makes your job a whole hell of a lot easier when you're a starting pitcher and the offense gives you 18 runs of support or whatever it was. So, like, that makes your life easier. But it was a good start. I'm pulling up the metrics right now on him. But I was pleasantly surprised for Dobbins to go out there and have the solid performance that he did.
Yeah, definitely me as well. So his line was 5 innings, 8 hits, so a lot of contact there, but only 2 runs, 2 walks, and 5 strikeouts. So, you know, that's a pretty quality start. I know he doesn't actually get the stat, but that is a solid major league debut. And especially when, like Zach said, your offense gives you 18 runs to work with, you will absolutely take 5 innings of 2-run ball there.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. Now, for whatever reason, it doesn't just give you in the game logs their whiffs. So I got to pull up the actual Baseball Savant scoreboard to find that. But But yeah, I don't know. It's weird because, like, how much are you going to see a guy like Dobbins? Like, if you think about it, like, once the staff is back at full health, and I'm not going to include Cutter Crawford in that because it seems like he's quite a ways away, but we have Brian Bayo and Lucas Giolito both currently on rehab assignments. I'll have to pull up the numbers on Giolito, but Bayo is still only throwing in the 60s as far as his pitch count. So it seems like he's still at least two or more starts away. Mm-hmm. Giolito's just starting. I want to say he was in like the 58 range on his pitch count the other day when he made his appearance. So you're talking about pushing Sean Newcomb and Richard Fitz back down into AAA more likely than not. So now you're talking about both of those guys. We'll see what happens with Newcomb. Obviously, he has to be DFA'd, but I can't imagine that they wouldn't just immediately outright him to AAA after he clears waivers, or even stick him in that the Chase Anderson role.
Yeah,
and send Josh Winkowski back to the moon where he belongs. So we're talking about pushing him down another three spots. And then when Cutter Crawford comes back, if he comes back at all, I haven't seen an update on him in a while, but it felt like he was going to be a mid-season addition, if anything. So we'll see how things actually shake out. And then obviously everybody's looking for pitching at the deadline, and who knows, maybe the Padres come calling and they fall out of it. I know they've had a good start so far, but you're looking at Michael King or Dylan Cease or even the Diamondbacks with Zach Gallen, like any of these pending free agents, like who knows how the season shakes out. So I don't know how much necessarily we're going to see him the rest of the year, but it was certainly an encouraging cup of coffee to start his career.
Yeah, definitely. And on the offensive side, the team went 12 for 24 with runners in scoring position. And obviously that's a larger sample size than we'll see in most games, but you know, batting 500 with runners in scoring position, as opposed to what we've seen pretty much all throughout the year, has been failing to come up in these clutch situations. So it's an interesting sign. We'll see if that becomes a trend, because it didn't really as we got into the Toronto series. But it shows that the lineup is capable of doing this, and we just need to see them put it all together more often than not.
Yeah, and just on the as we transition there, I gave you the numbers for the St. Louis series, where obviously we know the offense was hitting like 385 with 30 plus runs scored in a three game set. In this Toronto series, it was the polar opposite. They hit 187, no home runs, 8 runs, 7 RBI, 10 walk, 40 strikeouts, which is just an absolute abomination, to only 12 walks. They only scored 8 runs in the whole series. And that's not to say that Toronto was some offensive juggernaut in this series, because they weren't. Obviously, his first game where they scored 6, I think it was. But similarly, it was a tale of two pitching staffs, where in the St. Louis series, your pitching staff had a 3.86 ERA compared to a 2.77, I believe it was. Yep, 2.77 in the Toronto series. So you got some really solid pitching out of your staff, and I'm sure the number is lower even for the rotation, because the rotation was great aside from Garrett Crochet, who wasn't sharp. And I kind of noticed that immediately, that he wasn't sharp in that first inning. And it was a start where he definitely had to grind through, and I know that the line ended up reading 4 runs, but only 1 earned, because the defense shit the bed per usual with this team. Maybe not this iteration of this team, but they kind of hung him out to dry there. But I mean, again, like, how many baseball games are you going to be winning when you score 2 runs? Like, not very many. So ultimately the onus falls on the offense, but encouraging sign from the pitching staff, to say the least, and capped off by Walker Buehler, who easily had his best start in a Red Sox uniform, 7 strikeouts last night. He said in his postgame presser that was more what he feels like when he knows he's going good. He said he felt like he was a lot more violent on the mound, which is a great way to put it. I feel like if Arcan said this last night, but in any other job, you're like, oh yeah, I felt really violent out there today. Yeah. And everyone's like, whoa, take it easy, man. But like, when you're talking about being a pitcher and attacking, you really filled up the strike zone. And obviously his strikeout line on the books was set at 3.5 at plus money yesterday, and he ended up striking out 7. So obviously better start than what Vegas was anticipating, better start than what I think a lot of us were anticipating, and an encouraging sign moving forward because they really do have a lot banking on Walker Buehler.
Yeah, yeah, it seemed like a bit of a get-right series for everybody not named Garrett Crochet on that starting rotation. I mean, even Richard Fitz on the opener of this series, where they ended up losing 6-2, he went six innings and only gave up 3 runs. Also, he walked a couple, he walked 4, which is not great, but also struck out 4. And swing and miss has always really been a question with Richard Fitz. So to see him even getting 4 Ks through 6 is an encouraging sign to me. I think he's also had 3 quality starts in his 3 starts so far this year. So
yeah,
decent signs, especially from your 4 guy, a guy who may not even be in your rotation when Giolito and Bayo and potentially Crawford come back. You might not even see him. Maybe he'll be in a 6th inning role or a 6th starter role, or in AAA. But either way, the pitching depth is in a good spot.
Yeah, and last year we said the same thing. We're like, oh, we think the pitching depth is in a good spot, and then immediately everybody went down and the pitching depth evaporated. And
right.
Some of it was a case of the depth just wasn't as good as you thought it was, and another case was just bad injury luck. I mean, obviously with Whitlock going down, and I hated the decision to have Whitlock be a starter anyways, but obviously his elbow explodes. Giolito's elbow explodes after like 1 inning of spring training baseball. So it's a little different. I mean, I know, obviously watching the Red Sox or the documentary right now, they did a whole big sequence on how much pitching depth they have and how great they feel about the pitching staff. And I think this year is a lot different, and one that you have guys that have done it before. And I know people have called Walker Buehler a reclamation project, and I understand kind of where they're coming from in saying that. But if he's a reclamation project, this is by far the highest ceiling reclamation project that they've picked up so far. Like, people are comparing it to James Paxton. Like, James Paxton has, his time had come and gone by the time that the Red Sox picked him up recovering off Tommy John. I mean, with Walker Buehler, we're talking about a guy who is 1.5 years removed from being a dominant pitcher. And I mean, there's a reason why the Dodgers trotted him out there to get that final out in the World Series. I mean, he was absolutely nails in the playoffs for them. So, and it shows in the monetary value too. I mean, they gave Buehler a pretty sizable deal to come in here. James Paxton was making like $3 million to come in and rehab, and then making $8 million the following year. So people comparing him to that, they fall into that same category of don't watch the games anymore because you don't understand what you're talking about. But to see Buehler come out and kind of get back to vintage Buehler, I mean, if he does that and Hauk can continue to capture what he was able to do on, was it Wednesday night against Kevin Gausman? I mean, he was great. Obviously, he struggled in his first couple starts. And I think the swing and miss is still a bit of an issue in terms of Tanner Hauk, and he's still not generating a whole lot of whiffs or strikeouts. So that's something to keep an eye on as we move forward. But if we're talking about Garrett Crochet, Tanner Hauk, and Walker Buehler having 3 starts emblematic of what they had in this series, then they're going to be in a really good place moving forward.
Absolutely. And this wasn't Crochet at even close to his best. I mean, you saw in the Baltimore series, he went 8 innings, struck out, what was it, 7 or 8 guys?
Yeah, 8.
Yeah. So, I mean, that's just scratching the surface of what Crochet can be. And even in this Crochet start, you saw the defense really kind of let him down there. Like Zach mentioned, he gave up 4 runs, but only one of them was earned. So if you can get out of that inning, there were a couple times where Romy Gonzalez just booted balls or people were made throwing errors all over the diamond in the infield. So obviously it was cold. But I don't know how much of an excuse that is for poor defense. We'll see if that continues to be a trend like it has been the past couple years.
Yeah, I have a quick rant on this. And obviously, okay, Campbell's defense loomed large a little bit in this one. Obviously, he made one of the throwing errors to allow a couple runs to score in that Crochet start yesterday. I know technically the error went to Story, but he wasn't decisive enough getting the ball to second base on that double play that allowed the Blue Jays to take the lead. Cora said after the game that he should just take it himself, and it's a work in progress, and he's learning on the job, and we'll get there. If he's a work in progress defensively at second base, why in the fuck are we dilly-dallying and fucking around with him in center field? Like, I understand lineup versatility, this, that we want to, there was a quote that they wanted to get David Hamilton some more regular at-bats to keep him fresh. If you have a top five prospect in the sport that you admit is a work in progress defensively at second base and has gotten on base, I have to fact check this now at this point, but I believe it still holds true, has gotten on base in every single game of his major league career, why the fuck are we putting him in center field for no damn reason when we know he continues to be a work in progress at second base to get Romy Gonzalez or David Hamilton into the lineup? These are jags. Like, these are just complete whatever bench pieces. We shouldn't be sitting here operating like where the Tampa Bay Rays being like, oh, we got to keep Hammy fresh because he's really fast and that's all he does well. And the extra innings at bat, the David Hamilton at bat in Wednesday night's game, he's swinging away, and I talked a lot about uncompetitive at-bats that end in strikeouts. There was not a more uncompetitive at-bat in that game than David Hamilton with the ghost runner on second base. And I know people are saying, well, why would you bunt? Because then you need to go for the win. Who's pitching the 12th? Who's doing this? You're losing by a run, and you have David Hamilton up at the plate. You fucking bunt the runner over. Even then, I know Ref Snyder popped out, and I disagree with having Ref Snyder be the pinch hitter there for Narvaez as well, but he ended up popping out. If the guy's on third base, you have the tying run, a sac fly away. There's so many more ways to score a guy with one out from third base than second base. And to have David Hamilton go up there, one, not even consider bunting, and three, or two, swing at three of the worst pitches that you'll ever see in your life. Like, it just makes no sense to me. Everyone's like, oh, you're just an old timer. Like, no, that's not, like, I'm vehemently against bunting in pretty much every situation. With David Hamilton up at the plate and the tying run on second base and extra innings, you bunt him over every single day of the week.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And I just had a stroke. We were texting about this. The lefty lineups, the lefty specialist lineups are really starting to piss me off because we saw a couple lefties in this series. And the lineups are just completely a mess. I don't understand why you need to have a platoon for guys who should be everyday players. Like, Tristan Casas is still not facing lefties every day simply because he's a lefty. Let's put in
Romy Gonzalez.
What's up?
Casas has a higher OPS plus against lefties than he does righties in his career. And obviously it's a smaller sample size, but like, he's shown that he can hit lefties before.
Exactly, exactly. And Romy Gonzalez, like you said, he's a jag. And he's a utility guy. He's speed off the bench. I'm tired of pretending Romy Gonzalez is anything more than a fresh set of legs when you need a steal or you need a speed on the base paths late in games.
Yeah, Willier sitting there against a lefty, I don't think it was as much as about the matchup as it was. We know Cora said he had heavy legs or whatever that means. I mean, obviously we know he had the delayed start to spring training, so I don't have as much of a problem with that. I do have a problem sticking Christian Campbell in center field, like I said, but I don't have a problem with him sitting. But Casas just needs to be playing every day, especially when you consider you have Romy Gonzalez as your backup first baseman. He's played 23 games in his career at first base, and they all came between this year and last year. So like, this is a guy who hadn't played first base at all coming into his Red Sox tenure, and you're like, just fucking stick him out there. I mean, I think that's not a huge roster construction flaw that they don't have a backup first baseman. And people are like, oh, why not just bring Dom Smith back? Because that's another lefty and he gives you no versatility. But like, I think there was a path where you could construct this roster without Romy Gonzalez and have a more viable backup first baseman. So when you do need to give Tristan Casas a blow, it's not like, all right, Romy, go out there and try to learn first base on the fly. Because as we saw, I mean, obviously he got screwed on some of these throws, but there were also plays that he needs to dig out, like the Bregman throwing error in that third game. Like, I know we saw Casas miss a scoop on what ended up being a Bregman error yesterday, or maybe it was a story error, I forget what it was. But I'm much more confident in Tristan Casas' ability to pick the ball than Romy Gonzalez.
Yeah, and on the backup first baseman thing, Abraham Toro is sitting in AAA right now. If you
Oh, that's right.
If you want a backup first baseman, he's played first base a hell of a lot more than Romy Gonzalez, and you still have speed off the bench with David Hamilton.
He still gives you versatility. Like, he's played all around the diamond. So.
Exactly. And I just don't know what is keeping Romy Gonzalez here, except that I've heard he's a vibes guy. Like, that's pretty much it at this point.
Yeah, I think he's the one that came up with the movie celebration or what. I still don't really know what it is.
Yeah.
When they get on base. But I guess he's the one that came up with that, which, like, I'm sorry. That's not enough for me to keep you around when I think you're pretty much useless otherwise. But, yeah, Cora, I think, is such a good manager. And we obviously know, and you haven't gotten into the Netflix doc, but you can see how much those guys love Cora and how much he connects with the players. And even in his weekly sit down with WEEI Afternoons this week, he talked about how the relationships mean so much to him. And he still gets texts from David Price, who's watching the Red Sox games, to support Cora. And Mookie said, like, oh, I still watch Red Sox games because I love AC. That's my guy. Like, we know what these kinds of relationships mean to him. So he's a great manager. I think he's a top three manager in the entire sport. But it does drive me insane how strict he plays these platoons, specifically against left-handed hitters. And I know we'll get into some of the Rafaela struggles in the Roman Anthony discourse as he's knocking down the door, and that volume of talk seems to get louder and louder with every Rafaela pour at bat. But Breslow said he told Chris Cotillo of Mass Live that they want to see Roman Anthony get some more ABs against lefties before they bring him up. Like, why? We know that he's not going to play against lefties for the entirety of his rookie year. We saw it with Abreu. We saw it with Casas. We saw it with Devers his rookie year. Like, we know that Cora plays strict platoons, especially for rookies. So I don't understand that, but that is one of the things that kind of bothers me about Cora. I mean, the rookies is one thing, because I think the general consensus is that if you're a major league caliber left-handed pitcher, you're already pitching in the big leagues. So in AAA, you're not really seeing that quality of left-handed pitchers, which I understand to an extent. But now we're talking about Tristan Casas, who I know technically service time wise, this is only year three, but he's seen parts of now four seasons in the big leagues. Like, this is a guy that if you're banking on him, which now they are, to my pleasure as a Tristan Casas guy, you're banking on him as the first baseman of the future now with Vladdy off the market. This is a guy that if he's going to become the Joey Votto, Freddie Freeman type that people projected him to be when he was a prospect, he's going to have to face lefties. Freddie Freeman's not platooning against lefties. Joey Votto wasn't platooning against lefties. And I think Casas has that capability to still be that kind of player. I know the results haven't been there early, but, like, it's 2 weeks into the season, one. And two, like, you have to let him go at some point. Like, they have to face lefties. And like I said, he has a higher OPS plus against lefties than righties in his career. So,
yeah, couldn't agree more. And if we're going to talk about the Rafael Devers slow start, then admittedly, as Casas fanboys, we do have to mention that right now he's batting 170. He has 8 hits, 1 home run, 3 RBIs. But the only way to get out of the slump, we saw it with Devers, was continuing to play him every single day and just letting him ride out this slump and figuring it out. You can't establish a rhythm if you're coming off the bench late in games, or you're not playing full games anytime they play a lefty. So I'm kind of sick of this narrative that Casas or any lefty can't face a lefty starting pitcher. I just don't get it, because ultimately, if the opposing team puts in a right-handed pitcher late in games, then you just see Cora doing this mass pinch hitting thing where all these guys come, they don't get a full off day just because he puts them in later in games when you probably could have benefited from their bats if you had them for the entirety of the game.
Yeah. And while we're on Casas, buddy, we've got to swing the fucking bat. We've got to take the bat off our shoulders. He is the most passive hitter I have ever seen. And I understand that he has a fantastic knowledge of the strike zone, but there's no challenge system. There's no balls and strike system or automated balls and strike system. The pitch at your knees, that is a ball that you get rung up on at least once a game. You got to start swinging the bat. We just have to, it feels like he's way too, like I said it before, but passive. He's just waiting for the perfect pitch to come, and then that's the one he's going to take a hack at. And for the most part, it's not paying off. And I think he's going to be really good next year when that challenge system comes in. But right now, it's not here. And even if you know that you're not going to be able to do anything with that pitch down at your knees, you just need to foul it off. You need to swing away. Like, I mean, he takes pitches that are so hittable, and it drives me absolutely insane. Like, we need to see, if you're going to be the four hitter, you need to be more aggressive at the plate. You need to be swinging at pitches to hit. Like, you're not going to get a perfect pitch to hit in every at bat, and that's okay. But getting more aggressive is absolutely paramount for Tristan Casas, because it feels like so many times he comes up and he's just sitting there with the bat on his shoulder, and then something will get called a strike. It's a borderline call. He sits there and shakes his head, and it's like, yeah, dude, it's not a strike, but like, it's close enough where we have to be swinging at it. And it, as the number one Casas fanboy, like, you know, it really takes a lot for me to be ripping him on that, but it drives me absolutely nuts watching some of these games and some of his at bats where it's like, all right, well, what are we looking for if we're not looking at like a 93 mile an hour sinker center cut? Like, and then we're looking at a pitch at our knees to strike out and walking back and be like, oh, that was a ball, so good at bat. Like, no, like, even if it was a ball and the umpire blew the call, that was still a terrible at bat because he didn't fucking swing.
Yeah, yeah, and I've noticed it throughout his major league career thus far, but it seems like it's coming up more in key spots this year than it has in years past. Maybe
because
that's
he's a cleanup hitter.
Exactly, yeah. Yeah, so where I'm at with that is you just got to be more aggressive, like Zach said. Like, I'm tired of him coming up in key spots and striking out looking. There's one thing to be striking out swinging. At least you recognize your pitches and think you can do damage. But when you're not even getting the bat off your shoulder, that is just a bad look from your cleanup guy.
Yeah, and I mean, I know we saw last year. I haven't heard him doing it this year. We know last year when he was at the plate and he would be like, as the pitch was coming in, he would go down or outside or up. I haven't heard him do that at all this year. So I understand that he has a great understanding of the strike zone. But that doesn't mean you can't be aggressive within pitches that are in the strike zone. If he starts swinging at some of these, like I said, center cut pitches that are perfectly good to hit and also continues having a good eye and not take swinging at the garbage, like, we know the chase isn't going to be there with Casas. So that's why I think he can be such a good hitter. It's just he needs to just put it all together at once. Like, I don't know if they're telling him that and he just hasn't made the adjustment yet, or if Pete Fatsy's just a fucking moron, which I wouldn't discount. But it just feels like such an easy fix to make. So I don't know whose fault it is. I'm inclined to think that the coaching staff of the Boston Red Sox aren't fucking brain dead and are telling him like, hey man, like, we got to swing. Like, I wish someone would ask Cora that. Like, that would be the first thing I would ask Cora if I got any type of media access to ask him a question. Like, is Casas not being aggressive enough at the plate?
Yeah. Yeah. It would be interesting to hear the responses, because it seems like we're kind of skirting around this subject. Like, I don't hear a lot of people talking about it probably as much as they should.
People just rip him for not being good, and obviously we know they don't like him because he paints his nails. And I think it was in the trailer, so I'm sure you saw this clip, but he said that everything that people don't like about him is exactly why he does it. That's why he paints his nails. That's why he goes out there and sunbathes and etc. And I don't know. I love Tristan Casas. I tweeted it every time people hate him, the more I love him, but like, that doesn't make you immune to pissing me off in terms of like your actual play on the field. Like, I think it's stupid to be like, oh, fuck this guy, he paints his nails. Like, I mean, you're just telling on yourself for being homophobic, first of all. Like, nobody cared when pitchers were painting their nails. Or catchers, excuse me, when they still had to give signs. I mean, we remember the 2013 season, Jared Saltalamacchia had to have like neon yellow nail polish on because Jake Peavy was kind of blind. Like, nobody had a problem with it then. Like, I do have a problem with him not swinging the bat at all.
Yep. I'm with you there. I wanted to take us through this bottom of the 10th inning yesterday, if you didn't have anything else on the rest of this series.
Yeah, I think I'm good on that. Obviously, it was a sleepy series for the offense. I think we kind of covered it as best we could there.
Yeah, pretty much. And I mean, we touched on all the pitchers as well. So I think we're good to, so this was an interesting game because the bats were not really cooking at all this series. And even in this game that they ended up winning, a couple of their runs were basically just flukes, I feel like. So, I'll take you through this summary of the bottom of the 10th inning yesterday. So the Red Sox were down 3-2 because the Blue Jays scored in the top of the 10th. So Nick Sandlin replaces Yimi Garcia. Garcia was a little bit suspect in this game, but ended up not allowing anyone.
You know his name is Jimmy?
Jimmy?
Yeah, oh yeah, Jimmy.
I thought it was Yimi.
That's how it's spelled. Pronounced Jimmy.
Who's calling him Jimmy?
So I remember hearing he was obviously he got traded last year to the Blue Jays.
Yeah.
I forget where he was. But I remember last year, I forget who said it, but they said it was Jimmy. And I was like, no, that'd be Yimmy. And they're like, no, like the media pronunciation guide says Jimmy. I'm like, there's no fucking way that guy's name is Jimmy. It starts with a Y.
Yeah, where is the J in there?
Yeah, and then yesterday on the broadcast, sure enough, Jimmy Garcia.
Okay, so Nick Sandlin replaces Jimmy Garcia, I guess. and then, okay, so Blake Sable starts on second base as the ghost runner. Jaron Duran singles, Sable scores. And then Duran gets caught stealing, and you're like, well, this is probably headed to the 11th inning. At this point, Rafael Devers hits a single on a line drive. Alex Bregman gets hit by a pitch. Tristan Casas gets hit by a pitch. So bases are loaded. And this is with one out. Trevor Story comes up to the plate. What does he do? He grounds at, this was like a dribbler. I don't even know if it made it past the pitcher's mound.
It was like right around the pitcher's mound, right around there.
Yeah. Yeah. And so technically a ground out, but since the bases are loaded, who is it? So that would be Devers comes in to score, right? So that's how the game ended.
Hamilton. Pinch ran Hamilton.
Oh, right. Devers. Yes. Okay. Yeah. So Hamilton as the pinch runner comes in and scores. Game over. This was maybe one of the weirdest walk-offs I've ever seen. Like, it kind of had a bit of
everything. Went down as a ground out. Ground out because Jimenez threw it to first after he bobbled it, which like he would have had the guy at home if he just took like an extra beat. And I know David Hamilton is fast and was like getting down the line, but we're talking about a ball that was hit like right around the pitcher's mound. Like he was out at home. You're probably not getting the double play, but it was a weird walk off.
Yeah. Yeah. And all this to say that I don't know. I just kind of like them finding ways to win, even when shit is going south. Like, obviously, a lot of this was because Nick Sandlin couldn't find the zone and was hitting people left and right. So maybe this was in spite of their poor offense. But a walk-off is cool any way you put it. And maybe a little bit of momentum heading into this White Sox series.
Trevor Story is getting way too much credit for that. You ground it out.
Well, yeah. I thought so. Like, you mean for the season as a whole or just this walk-off?
Both.
Okay.
Like I don't know. Like it's so easy to be like, oh, I've seen enough of Trevor Story. We talked about it with Anthony. We talked about it with Campbell. Like with Meyer, he's a similar caliber prospect. I mean, we've seen so much prospect fatigue on guys who bounce around in the minors for, and I won't even say a long time because technically this is only year three of Meyer in the system. Or year four of Meyer in the system, drafted in 21. I can't imagine he played a game in that end of summer of 21 after playing an entire high school season. So he got injured. We see guys like that fall off those top 100 rankings. I mean, fuck Kylie McDaniel, or is it Kylie McDaniel? Whoever the ESPN prospect guy is, has him as the number two prospect in baseball. Like whenever you have a guy like that, that's knocking down the door, and he's been great in AAA to start too. Like it's easy to be like, all right, I've seen enough of Trevor Story, but like I've seen enough of Trevor Story. And I can't remember if I said it on the last episode, but like, it's not like we're never going to see Trevor Story again, because we know, and same thing with like Sadan Rafaela, we know that Cora's would rather die than let these guys face a left-handed pitcher. So like, we're going to see these guys anyways. Like, I'm kind of just ready to pull the plug on the Trevor Story experience. I understand why they're not, because it's Major League Baseball. What does it say if you can lose your job after like 14 games? Like, oh, mm-hmm. like, you got off to a slow start. Sorry, but we got Roman Anthony coming up. Like, I think it's a little different with Sadan Rafaela, who hasn't been – he, like, has stretches, but he hasn't really shown too much at the major league level. A guy like Trevor Story, who's been around the block, he's been in the league for quite a while. He's been an all-star. He's been a Gold Glove caliber defender. I understand why that guy's not losing his job yet, but I don't know. I've seen enough. I'm ready to see Meyer and Anthony, and especially now, I guess it doesn't really matter because the deadline for the prospect promotion pick incentive is come and gone. Mm-hmm. So now at this point, you're not getting a pick if either of those guys wins rookie of the year. But I don't know. I'm getting pretty close to just being like, all right, it's Marcelo Meyer time. I just haven't been that impressed with Story. And like, yeah, he put the ball in play. And Cora yesterday was like, that's why we preach putting the ball in play. It's like, well, first of all, you guys don't put the ball in play very often. You strike out a ton. And two, Trevor Story grounded out. Like, yeah, that's what he did. Like, if Andrés Giménez didn't suck, we're still playing baseball right now, maybe.
Yeah, it is a good point. I think he's gotten off to a decent start, Trevor Story. Like, he's had a couple errors, but he has 4 stolen bases. I think he's like 14 or 15 hits thus far. So, you know, a productive hitter, but I wouldn't mind seeing him be a platoon bat at this point if you can get Meyer up. And also maybe that opens the door for getting some other guys off this team, like Romy Gonzalez, who I'm just so far out on. And I have been for a little while. But we do have a couple other things to touch on. Not a whole lot in terms of Red Sox news off the field in this past week, like we had the extensions last week that we obviously broke down. But do you want to start with the Quinn Priester trade? Because I know we mentioned it for a little bit, but didn't really get in depth there.
Yeah, I don't have too much on that other than it's okay. A classic Craig Breslow masterclass. Mm-hmm. They get, how did you say his name? Yoferi?
Yoferi, I'm pretty sure, yeah.
Yeah, Yoferi Rodriguez, who was the Brewers' top paid international signee in the most recent class. I think organizationally, he was number 8 for them, 7 okay. or 8 in that range. You get a competitive balance round A pick, which is what they give out to the like small market teams to balance out them not being able to spend big money because they don't generate a ton of revenue. I think it's them, the Rays, the Marlins, handful of other, like maybe one or two other teams that get those picks every year. You get that pick, which is at the end of the first round, I believe it is. So like, and it's an additional $2.7 million in your draft bonus pool. So it significantly alters the amount that they're able to spend. And it'll be interesting to see how they approach the draft. Do they go after a high-priced pitcher that, or high-priced high school guy that is considered to be a hard commit, like we've seen them do in the past with Blaze Jordan and Roman Anthony, two examples of that. Obviously, with those, they had to go under slot with their first pick. With if it was it was Mikey Romero and Nick York, I believe it was in those 2 years. So it'll be interesting to see how they approach that. Obviously, they lose their second round pick for signing Bregman, but they gain a second round pick for the Padres signing Nick Pivetta. And then obviously, I'm not sure if the odds have changed at all. I can't imagine they have. Currently, Christian Campbell's the favorite to win Rookie of the Year, and he is eligible for that pick. So it'll be interesting to see how they approach, I guess it would be this year's draft, and then the Campbell pick would be next year's draft. So in a good position farm system wise, and then whenever you can add a guy who was top 10 organizational prospect for, like we said earlier, a guy in Quinn Priester who seemingly has been jumped on your depth chart by a whole bunch of different guys, Dick Fitz, now Hunter Dobbins, not to mention some of the guys that are in Double A, David Sandlin, who Sox Prospects has as the top ranked pitcher in the organization. Yep. You also have guys like Yordani Monegro, Luis Perales working his way back from Tommy John, who prior to that was the top pitching prospect in the organization. So There's just a lot of things to like about this trade. And I know Priester was good yesterday for the Brewers in his debut there, but this is a trade that it's tough to be like, oh, they lost this one.
Yeah, I agree. I think with the pitching depth, and also you didn't have Priester around for very long, and the Brewers were in desperate need of pitching. So you kind of saw Craig Breslow take advantage of that and getting a hell of a lot more of a return than I ever would have expected for Quinn Priester, to be quite honest.
Yeah, I don't think it's a stretch to say that in totality, like trading Nick York for that pick, mm-hmm. the prospect, and the extra flexibility in your draft pool is a major win there. I mean, Nick York is a guy that can't even crack the Pirates right now.
Right.
So it's like, it's one of those things where I'm very happy with the trade in totality. I know a lot of, like, at first it was like, oh, that's weird. They just flipped Nick York for Quinn Priester and they're already out on him. And I don't know if maybe it just didn't click with him in the pitching system, or maybe mm-hmm. they just felt comfortable about what they had depth wise. And they got such a good offer that it was hard to refuse, which I think it was probably more that than the former. But great trade by Craig.
Yeah, definitely. I don't have anything else to add on that trade. We'll see how it develops. But yeah, I'm happy with the draft pick. I'm happy with the player they got. And we'll see how it pans out from there. But the last thing we have before we preview the White Sox series is a little bit of a sensitive subject, but it's something that I think we should talk about because it's been kind of circulating Boston media since it came out. So if you haven't heard, in a preview for The Clubhouse, the Netflix series that recently came out earlier this week, Jaron Duran talked about his struggles with mental health. And we kind of knew this about Duran. He has always been more outward than most about his mental health struggles and everything like that, especially when it was going bad for him. I'm going to come right out and say that Jaron Duran is my favorite player on the team. He has been for a while now since he started talking about the mental health stuff in particular, because I think it's a topic that a lot of professional athletes are hesitant to open the door on because it brings a lot of baggage and it brings a lot of doubters and more criticism. And as a person who goes to therapy regularly, I think it's awesome that people are using their platform to talk about this, especially as dudes. It's tougher to talk about your mental health, and you know, society doesn't always make it the easiest to open up about those things. So all this to say that a story came out that Jaron Duran said that he had a suicide attempt in 2022. So I'll read the quote here just because I don't want to get anything wrong. He said, "I got to a point where I was sitting in my room. I had my rifle and I had a bullet and I pulled the trigger and the gun clicked, but nothing happened. So to this day, I think God just didn't let me take my own life because I seriously don't know why it didn't go off. I took it as a sign of I might have to be here for a reason. So that's when I started to look myself in the mirror after the gun didn't go off. I was like, do I want to be here? Or do I not want to be here? That happened for a reason. And obviously you're here for a reason. So let's be the way you want to be and play the way you want to play and live the way you want to live." Damn.
Yeah. Good stuff out of Jaron Duran. It's hard to go on top of what you said. I think you hit the nail on the head there with the, it's tough for guys, especially professional athletes, because everyone looks to professional athletes as like the paramount of mm-hmm. manliness and manhood and what have you. And don't discount the fact that these are real people. And I know that I believe it was in the Mass Live article that Chris Cotillo wrote, he expanded to say that like all these fans were talking so much shit to me. And it's like, yeah, I haven't told myself things 10 times worse than that in the mirror when I get home. So mm-hmm. Credit to him for opening up. I think it's become less stigmatized in the modern age of athletics now. And I know there's still always going to be the old heads that are like, oh, you're a fucking pussy. Like, and I vehemently disagree with that, but like those people are just from a different generation. And like, for the most part, those people are fucking dickheads anyways. Like it's something that, I mean, fuck, if you go back historically, people coming back from Vietnam, Korea, even dating further back, World War II, World War I, like it was just something that like these people, they smoked cigarettes until they had a heart attack and died instead of actually addressing their mental health problems, or they drank themselves into liver failure, things like that. Obviously, that's not the way you want to go. So like, oh, I'm a man. I bury my problems deep down and drink myself to death instead. Like, okay, well, like, it is nice to see Duran come out. And I know that Nesson said that the Good Sam line that they gave out on their broadcast, they said that they saw a 2x increase in people. They're 25 or under line. So obviously Duran's words are having an impact on people who are going through similar things that that he went through, which is fantastic to see him using his platform for good. I saw some other people on Twitter and elsewhere being like, oh, he's just trying to get a PR win after using a slur last year on the Hot Mic. It's like, yeah, I don't think that's how the, first of all, we don't know when that episode was filmed and when that story was told in terms of timeline. So like that could have been well before he ever said that as a, on the field, but it's also like that's just not why he did that at all. And he made that, like, he didn't directly address that because I think it would have been foolish to be like, and to the people that think I'm doing this for a PR win, you're wrong. Like that would have been taken away from the magnitude of what the story became and like what the point of telling that story was. But like that, like you're straight up dumb if you think that he was just doing that to get a PR win. Like he was doing that because he got himself out of, like, through the help of, like you said, therapy and whatever other method that he went through to get himself out of that, like, dark place. He went through those mediums and those channels and was able to pull himself out of that. He wants to do the same for other people. And obviously we can already see the impact that that's having just in the statistics that those resources are reporting since the story came out.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I'm very glad that he's still with us today. I'm glad that he's still on the Red Sox, and I'm glad that he got himself out of that dark place and is now one of the best players on the team, because he's an electric factory. He is a very exciting and fun player to watch. And I've been rooting for him for a while. And this just is sort of the icing on the cake in my liking of him.
Yeah. It's hard to understate how important it is for someone like that. I mean, this is a guy who was the All-Star Game MVP, finished top seven in MVP voting. He's become a superstar in Major League Baseball over the last year and a half or so. So for him to come out and say that he struggled with things like this, it opens the door for not only people who aren't in that position to address their problems and feel comfortable in doing that, but also other athletes, because you don't really know what some of these other guys are going through. I mean, again, not to give too much away from the Netflix doc, I actually haven't gotten to that episode yet. It's the next one that I have coming up here. But they show him misplaying. He lost the ball in the lights against the Blue Jays in 2021. Yep. And then, like, just kind of dogged it going after the ball. Verdugo had to come over from left to play the ball inside the park grand slam. They showed him losing the ball in Kansas City and then fighting the fans, or getting into a verbal altercation with the fans. So to see how far he's come since then. And like, I mean, obviously playing in a market like Boston, when like Duran obviously wasn't as hyped of a prospect to say like a Roman Anthony or a Christian Campbell, but this was a guy who was a top 50 prospect before those guys really emerged. And so there was a lot of pressure on him to come up and be that guy. And obviously playing Major League Baseball is hard. Like it has a 70% failure rate if you're really good as a hitter. And to be playing in that kind of media market like Boston and not immediately come up and struggle while you're also battling some of your own inner demons, it's obviously not a very conducive environment for doing that. So for him to come out and be like, all right, I'm playing in what is one of, if not the toughest media market in sports, and I'm still able to come out and say this type of stuff. And like, he knew that there were going to be the dickheads that call them soft or call them a pussy and all that stuff. And he did it anyways, because the impact of what he was saying was that important. So credit to him for stepping out of his comfort zone, because I'm sure that wasn't easy to sit in front of a camera and tell that story. But the impact that it had, as he said it, if I can even save one life, then it was more than worth it to sit there and tell that story. And it seems like he's on his way to saving a lot more than just one life.
Yes. Yes, absolutely. And yeah, I'm glad we were able to talk about that. And I'm happy that, you know, everything worked out how it did. But yeah, we can preview the White Sox series here. We can start with game one, which is tonight. And that is Sean Newcomb versus Davis Martin. Martin.
Yeah, same however. Fucking guy.
Yeah.
Yeah, same thing. 28-year-old Davis Martin. If you look at his Baseball Savant page, it is a whole lot of blue. He doesn't generate any swings and misses. He doesn't strike anybody out. He has a league average walk rate. When the ball does get hit, it gets hit very hard and mostly right on the barrel. He's going to throw the kitchen sink at you. He's got a changeup, four-seam, cut, slide, sink, curve. Uses the changeup most often at 29%, followed by the four-seamer at 25%. Cutter coming in at 18%, slider 17%, sinker 7%, curve 4%. He comes into this one having made two starts, 11 innings pitched. He's only struck out four guys in those 11 innings pitched to the tune of a 5.73 ERA. He's about exactly what you would expect to be on the Chicago White Sox rotation, a team that just broke the record for having the most losses in a major league season in history and has now started out the season 2-10. This is a guy that if you don't light up, then I may be going to have a little bit more concerns about the offensive struggles than I had going into this series. I mean, when you talk about the Blue Jay series, aside from Easton Lucas, who is whatever, and we didn't really touch on him at all. He just diced you up, but
yeah.
And he's had a great start to his season and his major league career so far, but he's whatever. But then aside from Easton Lucas, you faced Jose Berríos, Kevin Gausman, and Chris Bassett. I mean, those are three really good major league starters. You're not going to see that in this White Sox series. So if those struggles continue, then it's kind of like, okay, like what are we actually doing here with the bat in our hands? This guy is, it's hard to say anything other than he sucks because he's terrible.
Yeah. A fair assessment. We can move on to game two. We have Richard Fitz versus old friend, Martin Perez.
Yeah, Martin Perez, he had a no-hit bid into the sixth inning, I think it was. Then he got pulled, and it was actually BC High legend Mike Vassell who blew the no-hitter for the White Sox. He was a Rule 5 guy taken from the Mets to the Rays. He didn't make the Rays, so they waived him. The White Sox claimed him, so he applies the same Rule 5 rules for the White Sox. But Martin Perez has been their best pitcher for the White Sox. We kind of know what he is, obviously, with his time with the Red Sox. He's not a guy that's going to generate a whole lot of swings and misses, but he also doesn't generate a whole lot of hard contact either. Mm-hmm. The K percentage is actually pretty high right now. In 12 and a third innings, he struck out 13 batters, most of which came in that first start where he had the no-hit bid. 0.73 ERA in those 12 and a third. Like I said, he doesn't generate a whole lot of hard contact. The average exit velo is 85, which is 88th percentile. Doesn't generate a whole lot of hard hits. That's a 29.6% hard hit rate. But he also hasn't been generating a lot of ground balls this year, which is odd for a guy that doesn't generate a whole lot of hard contact. It's only a 25.9% ground ball rate. He's got a cutter, sinker, change, curve, four seam. Cutter is the primary pitch, followed by the sinker and the change. Curveball he uses at only 7%, four-seamer at 3%. He's had a great start to the year, but at the end of the day, he's Martin Perez. This is a guy who's pitched 14 seasons of Major League Baseball to the tune of a 4.41 ERA in almost 1,600 innings of work. He's done a good job sticking around, but this is ultimately a guy that doesn't scare me too much. And when you consider the lineup that they're trotting out there for the White Sox, it feels like even if he is able to limit the runs that you're able to score, this should be a game that you still win pretty handedly.
Absolutely. Couldn't agree more. It is cool that Martin Perez is still kicking around in the majors, but he does not scare me in the slightest. And game three is a little bit of a return game because Garrett Crochet is on the bump versus Shane Smith. Real quickly here, I don't have the exact quote, but I think someone asked him today about his return to Chicago, and he was basically like, I don't really care. Like he didn't really think he didn't really think of it as some grand return. So that shows you how much he really misses his time there.
Yeah, and I feel like he must have been mentally checked out of the White Sox. Yeah,
it's hard not to.
Since like June of last year when his name started coming up in trade rumors. Here's the quote from Bradfoe and Baseball Isn't Boring on him returning. Typically, I'm an emotional guy. I pitch with emotion, but I have no emotion about that situation. 2020 through 2023 feels like a really long time ago. So like last year felt like it was my first year there. So he just doesn't, he just doesn't really have any attachment there. Also, Bradfoe quote tweeted his own tweet and said, something I learned about the Crochet deal. Breslow was asking the White Sox about him right after he got the job, despite Crochet still being a reliever at the time. So this is a guy that they were hot on the tail of for quite a while. But anyways, back to the White Sox and Shane Smith, Danvers legend. So really? Shout out to Shane Smith, Danvers Mass legend.
Nice.
He's actually been pretty solid for them in two starts, 11 and two thirds innings of work, nine strikeouts to the tune of a 1.54 ERA. He's got a four pitch mix, primarily using the four seamer at a 43% clip, followed by the changeup at 25, the slider at 23, curveball at 19. This is a guy who generates a whole lot of ground balls. He's a right-handed pitcher who ranked as the 26th best prospect after they selected him in the Rule 5 draft from the Brewers in the White Sox system. He is an 89th percentile ground ball percentage, 62 and a third percent ground balls. He doesn't generate a whole lot of barrels, only 3.4% barrel percentage, but he also doesn't generate a whole lot of strikeouts. He's middle of the pack whiff percentage, slightly below average K percentage, and also slightly below average walk percentage. I don't really know how the pitching run value is calculated on Baseball Savant, but that is all really, really red and really high. I assume it has to do with his high ground ball rate. Obviously, when you're hitting the ball on the ground, you're not likely to generate a whole bunch of runs in those games. So far, he's faced the Twins and the Guardians. In his first start, he went 5 2/3, allowing two hits, two earned, while striking out three and walking four. And then his most recent start came against the Guardians on Tuesday, I think it was, quick maths. He went six innings, two hits, no earned, hit a guy, walked a runner, and struck out six. So a bit of a mixed bag in terms of walks and control in his first two starts. This is a guy that it wouldn't shock me if he came out there and just completely diced up the Red Sox offense for no good reason, just because it seems like they're liable for one of those every now and then. Again, at 25 years old, only two major league starts under his belt, there's not a whole lot to go off of there. But again, he's going opposite Garrett Crochet, so it feels like another one where even if he has a good start, like even a start emblematic of that first start that he made against the Twins, 5 2/3, two hits, two earned, that should be enough for Garrett Crochet to shut down the pitiful White Sox lineup.
Yeah, I agree. I would ask for your prediction, but I have a feeling it's going to be the same as mine, which is a sweep.
Yeah, if they're not sweeping the 2-10 Chicago White Sox, I don't know what we're. I don't want to say I don't know what we're doing, because I guess anything can happen in baseball. I'll say this: if they lose this series to the Chicago White Sox, then like, what are we doing here? Like, this is a series that you absolutely cannot afford to lose.
Mm-hmm.
And honestly, if you don't sweep it, it's like it's another one of those things where it's like, all right, like we really need to be sweeping the White Sox, because when it gets down to the nitty gritty, and we know obviously we don't see the Yankees until June, so all those games against the Yankees are packed into the last 4 months of the season or 3 months of the season, whatever it works out to be. But these games against the White Sox can loom large. If you don't take care of business against the shit teams that you have to play, then it's going to make it that much more difficult when you're facing the Yankees or the Orioles or whoever it may be in the heat of a playoff race, in the heat of a division battle, and like you're in an absolute must-win situation because you only went 3-4 against the lowly Chicago White Sox.
Yep. And so following the White Sox series, the Red Sox have three games at Steinbrenner Field, the spring training facility of the New York Yankees, to play the Tampa Bay Rays. And then, yeah, well, so I guess next time we check in, we will also be previewing a Chicago White Sox series.
Oh, good. Yay. yeah, we don't have the pitchers yet for that Rays series, but they're another team that I think you should have pretty decent success beating up on. Granted, we can map out the way that that series may pan out, but also I mapped out Garrett Crochet's Fenway debut being on Monday, and it got pushed back, and I got screwed.
Yeah,
I don't know, which I can't even say I got screwed. I was still at the Tuesday game, so it just wasn't as a fan. So, but anyways, yeah, this is a two series here on the road where you should be able to take care of business. We should be looking at a 3-game set against Tampa?
Yep.
Yeah, I think at worst we should be looking at a 4-2 road trip and hopefully a 5-1 or even 6-0 road trip.
Yeah, I agree. I can list the three probables. ESPN maps them out pretty early and they usually change. But it looks like for right now we have is it Pepio? I'm pretty sure that they say it right. So Pepio, we have Littell, and then Taj Bradley. All three of which are probably their top three starters at the moment, with McClanahan not pitching right now. So could be a bit of a battle there. But it's a spring training facility. Cold will not be a factor in Florida, ideally. So I'm not super worried about it.
I'd have to look at the numbers, but I think the ball has been carrying pretty well in that park. I mean, it has similar dimensions. It has similar dimensions to Yankee Stadium. So maybe this is a series where we see Casas start to unlock a little bit, start to figure some things out. Obviously, Devers has already unlocked whatever was going on in his head, and he started to figure things out. But maybe we see a little bit of an offensive explosion. I mean, it's tough because when you look at the Rays, I think Zach Littell is fucking whatever. Like, he's talk about a jag, he's just a guy. But when you're talking about facing Ryan Pepio and Taj Bradley, those are probably the two best arms that the Rays have, like you said, with no McClanahan. And I'm not as high on Pepio, but I am a pretty big Taj Bradley guy. Mm-hmm. So it's a tough draw, kind of, especially when you consider the fact that you're having Crochet start against the White Sox. But again, this is a Rays offense that doesn't scare me a whole lot. Brandon Lau is probably good for a home run at some point in that series because he just absolutely crushes you. But other than that, like I said, you should be looking at 4-2 at the absolute worst.
Yep. I'm with you there. Did you have anything else to add?
Yasmani Grandal, minor league deal with the Red Sox. He has an opt-out on May 1st, so he's already got the clock ticking on that. He's got 3 weeks to pass Blake Sable, or who is the other guy, the catcher that they brought in? Sebby Zavala.
I didn't know he was still kicking.
Yeah, he's in AAA. So he has a couple weeks to pass it. I wouldn't Blake Sable because I would guess that they're just going to put him back up on the major league roster to replace Sable. I did see that there's, I forget who it was on Twitter, so credit to whoever that may be that tweeted that there's one thing that Yasmani Grandal still does very well at his age, and that's framing. So I would assume that that's the most pressing reason why they would bring him in, and we'll see what the bat can still do. I'm not expecting too much from him offensively, but I mean, Blake Sable is, again, he's just kind of whatever. He's a guy that couldn't crack the Giants, who I know they have had a pretty decent start, but that's not a guy that super scares me. Last year with the Pirates, Grandal hit .228 with 9 home runs, 27 RBIs. So it's not a guy that is going to be the all-star that he had been in years past. It's a minor league deal with an opt-out on May 1st. So it's not the end of the world if he comes up and doesn't really do anything. He played 72 games for the Pirates last year. So pretty decent sample size to not do a whole lot with the bat. But again, it's a backup catcher. And I think that the catcher position is one that needs to be addressed for as far as moving forward in the future. Obviously, losing Kyle Teal, I know that there are 2 first-round catchers in this year's draft. I forget what the other guy's name is. I know the catcher from Auburn, his name is Ike Irish, because That's a great name. So I wouldn't be surprised if we see a catcher, a college catcher, selected in this year's draft pretty early, especially with the extra picks that they now have. But as far as this year goes, it's just it's whatever move. I would guess that he's just going to be released on May 1st because he can't pass Blake Sable. And I haven't seen a timeline on Connor Wong, but I would imagine that a fractured pinky in his catching hand is not going to take a while, which we didn't touch on that. That happened in the Monday game. That must have hurt so fucking bad to get hit with a bat that was being swung in weather, in freezing cold rain that felt like it was 18 degrees.
Yeah,
like, that must have, like, I think my hand would have fallen off.
Yeah, I don't even want to think, like, my pinky hurts just thinking about that. And I know he hasn't been swinging a great bat, but Connor Wong, I mean, shout out. I hope your pinky heals, and, you know, that, I mean, that's kind of all I have to say about it.
Yeah, you're tougher than me.
Yeah. Oh, while you were talking about that, though, I did find the other catcher prospect, Luke Stevenson, from North Carolina, who I've actually heard about. I mean, Zach is way more of a prospect follower than I am, but I have heard the name before, so we'll see if maybe that pans into some Red Sox future draft plans.
Yeah, I wonder. I remember hearing that one of them was a much stronger defensive profile than the other. I can't remember which was which. I haven't gotten super deep into any type of draft prep yet, which I don't get crazy deep into it. I just kind of familiarize myself with the guys in that range of the Red Sox pick, and I know that Ike Irish is right in that range, and I assume Stevenson will be as well. But one of them profiles stronger defensively, and I know that, well, not know, but I believe that that's one of the reasons why they were more willing to move on from Kyle Teal. It just didn't really seem like he was making the defensive strides that they were hoping he would, catching the ball, or, well, not catching it, but calling games. His pop time decreased over the course of his time in the minors, et cetera. And I think I've said it on here before too, but this is a guy where if he wasn't a catcher, he probably wouldn't be a top 100 prospect in the sport based on his offensive profile. So, like, it sucks that Teal isn't here anymore, and it kind of, they're kind of hung out to dry right now as far as catching goes. But it seems like there's Sean Murphy might be available at some point. They have Drake Baldwin, who was one of their top prospects. I know he didn't get off to the hottest start swinging the bat, but he was also one of the unluckier hitters in the first 2 weeks. And Murphy's been back for a couple games now and has been solid, but I wouldn't be surprised if they moved on from him and his inflated contract. Maybe there's a deal to be made where you flip Yoshida for Sean Murphy, and it's a pretty even swap in terms of money. I think maybe Yoshida's owed a little bit more, so maybe you need to throw in like a back end prospect or a player to be named later or something. But I mean, there's still, we're only 14 games into the season, so we'll see how things pan out. Maybe Connor Wong starts to swing a hotter bat when he's back healthy again, or maybe Carlos Narvaez starts to piece it together. Obviously, he didn't have a great series against Toronto, but nobody did, so I'm not really going to be like, oh, this guy sucks as a result of that.
Yeah, I agree. And just a quick glance, it looked like Luke Stevenson profiled more as the defender. Yeah, I think he got a 55 fielding grade and a 60 arm. So, we'll see. We'll see if either of those guys factor in. But yeah, as always, this has been a ton of fun. Enjoy another week of baseball. Hopefully the Red Sox are, riding better than they were coming into this episode, but we'll check in with you guys next week. So take care.
See ya.